So we were discussing some basic graph properties. We're still with our definitions. Let me just repeat it again. So normally we always denote with n the number of vertices, and with z the coordination number. That is the average number of degree, and the degree normally we use k, I guess. I think it's normally k or degree. I'm not sure whether I denoted that. Yeah, k I is normally the degree of vertex I. So I'm just repeating that. If we have something like that, the degree here is 1, 1, 3, 2, 3, 1, 1. And the average degree is the average over that, which in this case would be 12 divided by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So z would be here 12 over 7. So the next quantity we want to define is the clustering coefficient. So, and that is the number of triangles. So, of small loops. So I may have a graph like that. And then I have a small cluster, which is a triangle. And that tells me that there are local connections. So that two neighbors of a certain vertex are also neighbors. And that we call the most elementary clusters. There will be more generic, more complicated clustering in communities, but that is the smallest clustering we can imagine, just a triangle. More easy it cannot be. So, and the clustering coefficient, which is always denoted by C, it is the probability to find triangles. So C is defined as the average number of connected pairs of neighbors. Pairs of neighbors. So what does it mean? It's very simple. So we take this central side here. This has four neighbors. 1, 2, 3, 4. In this case, we have six possible connections because 4 over 2 equals 6. So I have six possible ways to connect these ones. I could also connect this with this one. But I have only one connection which I can find, namely only one of them is connected. So the clustering coefficient here for this side, let's say I, Ci equals 1 over 6. Now if I take J here, J has two neighbors, and there's only one possibility to connect. So Cj equals 1 over 1 equals 1. And the clustering coefficient of the network, C, is the average clustering coefficient of all vertices. Like the like exactly in the same way that z, the coordination number, is the average over the degree over all lattice size. In the same way, the clustering coefficient of the network, c, is the average over the local clustering coefficients of all sites. And so let's make another example. We can also have higher clustering coefficient. Let's take the same example as above, but let's consider a more connected connected network like that. Then we see there's a plenty of local connections. And for example, the central side I has 1, 2, 3 neighbors are connected. It still has 4 neighbors, and 3 of them are connected. So in this sense, it would be 3/6. And let's consider something even more complicated, like this one. Then we see that we have 1, 2, 3, 4 connections between the nearest neighbor. So Ci would be 4/6. So this means it's a measure of how closely connected my neighbors are, so how much clustering I have in this case. And the important point is that the clustering coefficient of a random network is very small. Why is that the case? Because if you construct a random network and you start, so you have your vertices and you start to have add edges, like we do that for the exercise, then let's say you add edge here, the probability now to add an edge here is the same probability than to add it somewhere else. So it doesn't care whether these two are already connected to a common site. So the probability is the probability of any two sites to be connected. So C for a random network, Erdo is Reni, is P, it's just P, which is Z divided by N minus 1 proportional to Z over N. Because I count the total number of possible connections between the nearest neighboring sites. And with every site, I have connections, I have the probability P to be connected. So the total number average, the expectation value of the total number of connection is just P. And that means this is very small, because normally Z is finite, let's say 2, 3, or 4, and if N is very large, it goes to 0. And then we see that this is often not what we observe in nature. For example, if we take the network of a typical neural network, which has been measured in the brain, or any other most other networks which we can measure in the world, then we see this was from C. elegans from a small worm. Then we have n equals 282. The average distance is 2.6. The clustering coefficient is high, 0.28. And the clustering coefficient of a random network, which would have the same density of links, would be much smaller, namely 0.05, 4 times smaller. So that's very typical here, that the measured clustering coefficient is substantially larger than the clustering coefficient of a random network with the same number of sites and links. Or we take movie actors. So we can this, by the way, that is a, we come to that very in a short time, bipartite networks. So many social networks are, there are different kind of social networks, but many social networks are defined in this way, for example, by these movie actors or other kind of professions. You can say, when is a movie actor connected to another movie actor? Well, if they played in the same movie, then they know each other. So if you have a movie, let's say A, B, C, or so let's say Star Wars and whatever, Titanic and so on, and you have your actors, and in any movie, there have been many actors, and here also, and here also, many actors playing in the movies, but of course there are a few actors which have also being active in other movies. And then you can say, oh, then I can make a graph of the actors knowing each other, whether they joined a movie. So for example, here it would be these ones, and this one would have played together with all of them, so I would make a link to them. And these, of course, would also all be interlinked because they play together in the same movie theater, and so on and so on. So that is a social network way to construct, which is very popular. For example, board of directors, which is normally a social network discussed very often in the newspapers. So that in the board of directors of the so Aufsichtsrat in German, a board of directors in the big companies, there are always many people overlapping. So they are in the board of directors of Siemens, of Mercedes-Benz, and so on. And they have networks because they know each other, because they join the board of directors. So that is a very common way to define one type of social networks. And for example, if you analyze it here, you immediately will see that you have a very large clustering coefficient. Why do you have large clustering coefficients? Because by definition, because everybody co-acting in the same movie is connected with each other, so you have very strong clustering in these. And the clustering coefficient, so there's somebody, there are plenty of movie actors in the US. Somebody made a study and there are many more than you might believe. There are about 200,000 movie actors. Not everybody is famous, but that is N. L is also pretty short here. So they know each other essentially, and the clustering coefficient is extremely high, 0.8 about, because of the construction of this network, and the clustering coefficient of a random network would be very, very low for this large size, because it goes like 1 over n, 0.0003 would be zero random. So these social networks in general, not only these ones, but generally social networks have high clustering coefficients measured by this simple, very simple measure. It is just one simple measure. If you would construct a random network with the same number of edges and vertices, the clustering coefficient would be orders of magnitude smaller. Of course, this measure for clustering is just the simplest, and there are more sophisticated measures. And the problem is, if you go more sophisticated methods, there are many different ways to generalize that. And So this is the clustering coefficient is very universal. Everybody considers that. In more general method, then depends a little bit on what you really want to investigate. So we discussed already last time, just shortly, the notion of a clique. And a clique is also a local clustering measure. And that is defined as a maximal fully connected subgraph and just I'll make a few examples. So if I have this kind of graph, the maximal fully connected subgraph here is 2, this is 2, so the clicks which you find here are just cliques of sides 2, because this is a fully connected subgraph. And it's maximal. Why? Why is it maximal? Because if you add any other sides, it's not fully connected. Let me make another example. Here I have two cliques, one clique of size 3 and one clique of side 2. This form is a clique of 3 because they're all connected. But if I add another side, it's not anymore fully connected. And this is a clique of 2 because it's fully connected. But if I add any side, it's not connected. On the other hand, if I would have this one, I would only have a clique of 4 because everybody is connected. Or just to make an this one, then I have two cliques, both of 3. This is the clique, but I cannot add these sides because these two are not connected, so it's not anymore fully connected subgraph. So cliques are fully connected, but maximally. So you cannot add any other sides. If you would any other sides of the network, it would not anymore be fully connected. And so this is, of course, a very mathematical, rigorous definition of a clustering. And we see that the clustering coefficient there, C, is not necessarily clique, because this would be contribute to the clustering coefficient, but these also all would contribute, but there would only be one clique of size 4. And so this is mathematically pretty intensively studied issue. In graph theories, cliques are sometimes used, but not so much, because in many graphs, that may be a little bit too strict a definition. So what people consider more than cliques are a generalization, namely communities. And that is a little bit vague. That is like a clique, but not everybody needs to be connected. So that is a vaguely defined a community that is a collection of vertices, so a subgraph. This is a very high linking probability. And now, of course, it depends on the details. Why you say you have a graph, and you have a certain edges, and normally you have only very few. But then you have some communities which are pretty much connected. Then you would say, oh, this forms a community. But of course, it's not a clique. Why is it not a clique? Because these two are not connected, and these two are not connected. But the linking probability is very high. Well, this also has a high linking probability, but the other ones just have one or two edges going out. And this has a very strong linking probability in this community. And so people, of course, this is then depends mathematically very much how exactly you define that. But intuitively, this is something which happens very oft in social networks. You have communities where everybody knows nearly each other, but not necessarily. It could be the two person in the community, for example, in a Verein, in an association. You know most members of a social association, but not everybody. Nevertheless, you're part of the same social association, like the Ruder Club or so, and so you're part of the same community. So the linking density is very high, but not maximal. So communities is a very useful definition in social networks, but you have to work a little bit if you do a mathematical graph analysis to set your parameters to find these communities, because you have to set your thresholds of linking probabilities and so on. But intuitively, of course, that is what happens in daily life. Very large connection of social ties, but not fully connected. So let us go back for a short while to the cliques, because they are mathematically extremely well defined. And so how can we calculate or estimate the number of cliques in an Erdős-Reny graph? And there can be actually pretty large. So we have a graph of size n and with coordination number z. Coordination. I think I used here k. Why do I use k? And P equals Z divided by N minus 1. And so the question is, number of cliques of size K. So this is here K, the size of the clique. So that's a clique of size 2. This is a clique of size 4, and so on.
I thought that 2 meant 2 cliques in the first graph.
No, 2. Yes. I should put 2 to be here, consistent. I changed the notation. Yeah. So K is here. I have 2 cliques of size 2. Here I have a size, one click of size 3 and one of 2, one of 4, 2 of 3. Yeah, I changed notation between here and here. Of size k, so we call that nk. Wow. And so we can calculate that. And so that is now a typical exercise in random graph theory. We calculate probabilities. So what do we have at first? We look at all possible subgraphs of size k. That is the total number of subgraphs of size k, namely the number of k vertices out of n. Then the probability that everybody is connected. So how many connections do I have? I have k times k minus 1 over 2. So k times k minus 1 over 2. So that is the number of connections in the subgraph of number k. And they all have to be connected. And the probability that they're all connected is p to the number of connections. And then if I take another point, so that is my my connected subgraph. But if I take one other vertex, it is important that it's not connected with everybody else. It can be connected with 2 or with 3, but not with 4. So the probability is 1 minus p to the k, because with probability p to the k, it's connected to everybody, because there could be k connections. And now that should be true for all other n minus k, for all other vertices which are not part of my subgraph. So that is then the expectation value, ensemble average, of the number of k clicks in an Erdős Reinl graph with n vertices, and linking probability p. It's a very simple formula, and it's something typical formula of graph of Erdős of graph theory. And if you look at that, actually, of course, the probability to having clicks for very large n goes to 0, because we find this one here is going exponentially down to 0. But if n is finite, we will find for, let's say, k equals 2 as a function of linking probability p, and so we will find different very strict maxima. So what we will normally find, if you look at this formula and we plot that, that a certain n of k's are very large and other n of k's are very small. So normally this is a binomial-like, of course it's not a binomial distribution, but these are binomial factors, so are very sharply peaked normally. So certain size of clique will be dominant and other sizes of clique will occur very little. So let us come to some other general properties of graphs. We are here still in the introduction and in the overview of what kind of graphs all do exist. We were considering, and this is important as a reference model, the completely random graph. But there are also other extreme graphs. Or graph types which are interesting. One is a tree graph, and the other ones are bipartite graphs. So tree graphs are very popular among theoreticians, because you can also do easy calculations, but they're not very real. Well, then sometimes they're realistic, sometimes not. So tree graphs looks like a tree. You have a root, and you have branches, and these branches branch, and then you branch again, and so on. But tree graphs has no loops. Absolutely no loops. Then you have a tree graph. So this means also the clustering coefficient is 0, because for a clustering coefficient I would have at least a small loop. So in a tree graph I have absolutely no loop. This is very popular when you're doing theory calculation, because if you don't have loops you can do many, many things, and we will actually do that in this lecture analytically, and you can calculate branching processes. We will do a several examples. You can use branching theory because what can you do? Well, you can consider processes. We will consider example a very short time where you go from one vertex to another, and then you can branch. You can either go to here or here, and then if you're here, you can branch. You can go either here, here, and here, and so on. And then if you have no loop, you can do that until you have visited the full graph. And we will do that concretely, how you do that in mathematics, and then you can do very nice calculations. And it's actually not so bad, this approximation, even we see that in most real-world graph, we have local clustering in communities. If we forget about the local communities, if we look at the big structure, then we know that the clustering coefficient C, at least in random graphs, goes like 1 over n, so it goes to 0. And actually, you can also show that all loops in an Erdős Randi graph vanish. Go to zero in the thermodynamic limit and going to infinity. So if you have very, very, very big graphs, this tree-graph approximation is not too bad because clustering and loops become less and less important. So that's why you can often for, it's actually a pretty good approximation for very large graphs to consider loopless graphs. And we will consider this approximation quite a few times in this lecture. Another graph which is occurs quite often are bipartite graphs. And that is our graphs. These are like the movie actor graphs. We have A's and B sides. So let's say you have A1, A2, A3, and so on sides. And you have B sides, B1, B2, B3, B4, and so on. And bipartite means that B sides and A sides may be connected, but not A sides and B sides. So you can have these kind of links, but you never have a link between two B sides, and you never have a link between two A sides. That is called bi from two, bipartite. You can divide the graph into two classes. So you can make a division here, and if you cut all these links, you know you will get a disc. You will only have disconnected sides. And that happens quite often, especially in social networks, because of the constructions. For example, if you have here the movies and here the actors, you have a bipartite graph. You can integrate out one of them, let's say, take away the movies and say, when are the actors connected? But the original graph was bipartite, and if you reduce it to one of them, of course, you will get a normal graph, but this was a bipartite graph. They have also some special properties, but we are not so much interested here at the moment. But just important to know. So this is, you would still go on and do some general definition of graphs, but it now becomes a little bit more mathematical because we define the degree distribution and the graph spectra. So the degree distribution especially is something very, very, very fundamental. No graph theory without degree distribution. And the graph spectra is something more specific, one characterization, possible characterization of graphs. So what is the degree distribution? It is just a probability distribution of the degree. So let's make it a little bit more formal. So we call the degree distribution P of k. Sometimes you also will say pk, depending, but that is p will be occur very often, pk or sometimes like that, the degree distribution. So how do we define that? We define, let's say, with xk the number of sides with degree k. And then we just have that pk is xk over n. So very simple. Let's make an example. We can take this example here below. This side has degree 1 because there's one link, two links, three. I think I have to go up here. This has degree 2, 3, 1. This has degree 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 2, 3, 3, 2. Then we have here for this graph x of 0 equals 0. So there's no side which is not connected. X of 1 equals 2 because we have two sides having degree 1. X of 2, we have 1, 2, 3. X of 4 is, no, X of 3 is missing, sorry. X of 3, we have 1, 2, 3. X of 4 equals 0, doesn't exist. X of 5 equals 1, and all the other ones are 0. So in this case, we would then have here, for this example below, pk for k equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 would be 0 and 0. We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So we have 0, 1 over 9s, 2 over 9s, 3 over 9s, 2. And there was a 3, and then we have 1 over 9. And we see we didn't do any error. Why? Because it has to be normalized, of course, a distribution function, sum over k, pk equals 1. The probability to find a degree, a vertex with degree k, sum over all probabilities has to be 1. And that is the case here, sum over all probabilities is 1. And so this is extremely an important quantity. And we will discuss that in detail in many examples, what kind of degree distribution we will have. So the first thing we calculate is the degree distribution for a completely random graph. So we do something similar like here for an Erdős Rendi graph, but now we do the degree distribution. So P of k for Erdős Rendi. Just write it down and explain why this is the case. P of k equals n minus 1 over k. P k 1 minus p n minus 1 minus k. Why is that? I consider a certain side. Then I consider the probability that this side is connected with k other sides, and it's not, well, let's make it dashed line, full line, and it's not connected with the rest, not connected, and the rest is n minus k minus 1, because the total number of sides which are not my center side is n minus 1. So the probability that I'm connected is p. Now I have k sides I have to connect it with, is a p to the k. Probability being not connected, 1 minus p. And I have to do it for all these sides, so it's to the power n minus 1 minus k. Now this is a little bit complicated, but we can simplify that. And we do it in the following way. First of all, we do that n minus 1 over k, the binomial factor here, that is nothing else than n minus 1 factorial over k factorial n minus 1 minus k factorial. And this is approximately n minus 1 to the power k to k factorial. Because I can, this goes from the factorial, as if I divide by k factor, by n minus 1 minus k factorial, I have here k factors, n minus 1, n minus 1, n minus 2, n minus 3. But this is true if k is much, much smaller than n. So if the average degree is much smaller than n, then I can approximate that just by the upper power. Then I have here 1 minus p to the power power n minus 1 minus k. I approximate that to 1 minus z over n, because z over n minus 1, I can also z over n minus 1 I can put here to the n minus 1. And then I have here 1 minus p to the power minus k. Now we use the exponential, the representation of the exponential factor e to the minus x equals limit n going to infinity 1 minus x over n to the power n. Does anybody not know this formula? Die Darstellung der Exponentialfunktion.
No, the question, also da unten, ist es ein Mal,
ja. Everybody familiar with that? Everybody knows how to prove it? Yes? Okay, then. How do you prove this relation? Any suggestions? It's very simple. We'll just prove that. You take, first of all, the exponential function is defined by two things. One is e to the, let's say this is f of x. So f of 0 equals 1, and f prime of x equals f of x. That's the definition of the exponential function, or at least in this case, if it's e to the minus x, that's a minus sign. That is the definition of the exponential function. And if you calculate the left and right hand side, you see the same. For 0, it's of course true. It's the same. And if you take the derivative of, in this case, here's a minus sign because of e to the minus x. If you take the derivative, the left hand side is of course this. And for the right hand side, the derivative with respect to x is n minus 1, as n, sorry. Yeah, n times 1 minus n, 1 minus x over n to the n minus 1. This here is just minus 1, and n and n minus 1 is essentially the same in the thermodynamic limit. So it comes out of the same. Of course, this is a way of for physicists to prove a formula. Mathematicians would be a little bit more rigorous. Yeah. Okay, so we use these two formulas, and then we have P of k is approximately n minus 1, sorry, n minus 1 to the power k over k factorial. Then I have here P to the power k. Then I have here e to the minus z. If I did it correctly, e to the minus z. And what do I do here? Wait a minute, something is wrong here still. Where is my 1 minus? X. Oh, yeah, and this I forget here, sorry. And so this is more or less e to the minus z, because p goes to 0, k is finite, so I also forget about this factor. And so I have k factorial, p, n. Yeah, and so then this is more or less e to the minus z. N minus 1 is more or less 1. So I have p times n to the power z divided by, to the power k divided by k factorial. And this I can simplify. Pk equals e to the minus z, because p times n is a coordination number z, z to the power k divided by k factorial. So that's the Poisson distribution. And so if you plot that as a function of k, pk, you see it goes up like a power here. But eventually, it goes down exponentially, so it has some maximum and then goes down exponentially, and the maximum is somewhere around the coordination number z, which is since z is the average. So is this normalized? Is it really a distribution function? That is always we have to check. Of course, the Poisson distribution is normalized. So sum over k, pk equals e to the minus z. Sum over k, z to the power k to k factorial. Now, this is just the exponential function. So this is just e to the minus z, e to the plus z equals 1. And we can calculate the average. So what is the mean? The mean degree using the Poisson distribution function. So that is sum over k, k, pk. That is the average degree or the expectation value of the degree k. This is nothing else than e to the minus z, sum over k, z to the factorial k minus 1 to k minus 1, factorial times z. Because I can, this k canceled with this, and I took out one of the z I took out. Now, this is again nothing else than the exponential function. So this is e to the minus z, e to the z times z. So that is just z, the coordination number. So that's not really too surprising that the average degree is the coordination number what we put in. So that's the Poisson distribution function. So for a completely random graph, the degree distribution is Poisson-like. For a large system size n. Of course, if you have a small graph like n equals 5, like in the exercise, that is not really correct because all of these approximations we did here. But for very, very large n, that is correct. Oh, I think I forgot about the break. We just stop a little bit earlier. Yeah. Good. So one could also calculate, I'm not doing the calculations, but just mention that. So that is the average distribution for a given graph. But I can also, of course, now question, if I have a finite graph, a large but finite graph, how much does the actual distribution, which I measure, for example, for n equals 5 or a little bit larger graph, maybe n equals 100 or so, how much does this distribution, which I would measure there, deviate from the Poisson distribution function? Because the Poisson distribution function is valid if I do an ensemble average over all realization. But if I take a one realization of a graph, of course, the distribution can be very different because in a one realization, in principle, I could have a graph. Let's say I'm making just an example now, one moment. Let's take the following graph. This is n equals 5 and z equals 2. But this is, of course, the degree distribution of this graph is not is a possible realization of an Erdős. This is a possible realization, a very unlikely, but possible realization of an Erdős or any graph with these two parameters. But of course, the average realization of an Erdős Rendi graph with such kind of parameters would look very 1, 2, 3, 4, or maybe 5, maybe it would look like that or so. And here the degree distribution is very non-Poisson-like, namely p of 0 equals 0, p of 1 equals 0, p of 2 equals 1, and the other ones are all 0. So one given realization, it's very unlikely that I get this realization, but it's a possible realization. So, and the difference between here and here, we can call ensemble fluctuations. So fluctuations in the realization. So this we will not do very much in this course. I'm just mentioning the formulas in the case you find that in your research or in your work or in the literature or whatever, that this is, if you want to do more detailed mathematics, that is an important quantity to consider. So pk is as defined as 1 over n x of k. So where x of k is the ensemble average over all k. So that means here average over all realizations or ensemble average. And now, if you consider a given realization, you might consider the probability that you have a deviation from that. So you may consider the probability that in a given realization that this x of r, this the number of vertices with a given degree k, is r, and r is not what you would consider here. So here you would then say, on the average, the number of vertices with degree k is pk times n. But for every given realization, that might not be the same. Xk might be different, namely might be something r. And then you can calculate that. We don't do this calculation, but it's a very similar calculation. Is some e to the minus lambda s times lambda s to the power r over r factorial. So that is also very similar, as you see. It is a Poisson distribution, exactly like here, only that lambda s is something else, namely lambda s is just this one here, is just xk, the average number of the expected number of k's. With very similar method, one can calculate that. So then you can calculate. So you know that this distribution function has as an average, exactly like we have here. The average here is z. The average over this Poisson distribution function is lambda s, so xk. That's what we know. But the deviation is Poisson-like from the thermodynamic limit. That is, by the way, very similar calculations you do in physics. If you would do, normally we don't do that, if you would prove the law of a large number, namely that the thermodynamic laws which you derive in physics are independent of particle number and other fluctuations, then you have to consider these kind of ensemble differences. How much change does the randomness changes when you have a when you say the pressure is like that, and the temperature is like that, and the energy is like that, that is, of course, only within fluctuations. But with 10 to the 23 particles, these fluctuations are so small that we can forget about that normally. But actually, nowadays, in physics, since we're coming back, nanophysics and the physics of small number of particles, only 100 or thousands, is becoming of interest and relevant. So these ensemble fluctuations for a small number of particles, since we do plenty of nanophysics nowadays, are becoming more important. They used to be pretty irrelevant in the past. So this is a side remark. As I said, we will not consider ensemble fluctuations or deviation from the ensemble average in detail here in this course. But we will consider, however, very often scale-free graphs. And in various contexts. And a scale-free graph is a graph where for large k, the tail goes like pk proportional to 1 over k to the power alpha. So let me first make a general remark. The tails of graph are important and are studied many, many times in many different tails of graphs, of distribution functions, sorry, of distribution functions. So I will explain shortly why this is called a scale-free distribution. But let me make a first general remark about tails. So you have a certain distribution function, for example, p of k or something else. And here this is k. And it might be something. And then you're interested, what happens for large? You know that very, very often in physics, for large distances, we have I will come back to that many times. We have exponential decay because of friction and other things, let's say large times. So the question is it whether it's proportional to exponential e to the minus k over psi for k going to infinity or other or not. And one makes a distinction if the tail goes down very fast, that is a normal distribution, because that means big events are rare. If the tail goes down fast, that means something which has a big number happens very seldom. And that is what we normally expect. Big events are rare. But there's a huge literature about distributions with so-called fat tails. So this goes a little bit beyond what we're doing, but let me make a few remarks. And these are extremely important in financial, in the financial industry, stock market, in catastrophe theory, namely if you want to estimate how likely a disaster is. For example, you're living in the Netherlands, and you have to build a dike, a barrier. And then you have to calculate it. How large does it have to be? 5 meters, 10 meters, 15 meters, 20 meters. And now you cannot just say, because they are very expensive, you cannot say, just do 20 meters higher and then I'm on the sure side. You really have to do a very careful estimate how is the probability of a rare event. A rare event is it's a huge tide coming with a huge storm coming and everything together. And you have to calculate this probability. And the question is, these rare events are distributed exponentially, so they're extremely seldom, or whether this distribution has a fat tail. And then you have to be more cautious. The same is in the stock market. You are investing. And every day in the stock market, the price of your stocks changes a little bit. But sometimes you have big events. The price changes very much. And if you're an investor, these big events can kill you or give you all the money. And so you have to be extremely knowledgeable about these rare events. And for example, in the stock market, it's very well known, if you look at the daily price changes, so the probability that the price changes or the monthly price changes that you have many, many small ones, but it doesn't go down exponentially, but you have very, very long fat tails. Of course, it has to go down because the probability distribution is normalizable, but it's not going down exponentially. You have fat tails, of course, it's very small probability, but it's not going down exponentially. And so these rare events are much, much more often than you would naively expect, because naively, with our intuition, we always have, psychologically, we calculate with exponentially small events. And so these fat tails are a very, very big mathematical and of very big economic importance questions. And they're very different kind of fat tails and why they occur and what and the theory. And one particular form of a fat tail, which we are interested here, are scale-free graphs. So first, let me say, why are they scale-free? They are scale-free because they don't have a scale. What does it mean? If you have a scale in physics, you have a characteristic length. The wave function of an atom has a characteristic length, angstroms. If you go 10 angstroms away, the probability to find the electrons is exponentially down. You have a finite probability. Here not, because if you have pk, let's say I have a typical k0 divided by k to the alpha. Or then say, oh yes, I have a typical k, which is k0. I have a typical scale. But no, that's not true, because you could put something completely different here. So because this is identical to k0 times k1 divided by k1 times k to the power alpha. I just multiply and divide by k1. So this is just nothing then k0 divided by k1 to the power alpha times k1 to the alpha. I just scale the factor out. And now I say this is just a constant, which I need to normalize that, because it doesn't matter, because I need to normalize it. And now I say, well, my scale is k1. And I can do it with every k1, k0. So it's scale-free, because it has no scale. That's why that is. That is scale-free. So you cannot say there is a typical size of an event. There is no typical size of the event. All events can occur. There is no typical size. And we'll discuss later on why scale-free graphs are so often and occur quite often. Of course, normally we consider this just for the tail. So here, something else could be happen. Of course, if you do a log-log plot, this is a linear graph. So it needs to be normalizable. So if we do the sum over k pk to an upper boundary gamma, then this is here. If we don't consider the normalization factor, the sum over k up to a factor gamma 1 over k to the power alpha. So that's approximately, since k is very large, here we can do an integral here. Integral over k dk from some lower boundary, we are not interested, to an upper boundary k, 1 over k to the power alpha. And now we can do that. This is proportional to k to the minus alpha. This is proportional to k to the 1 minus alpha divided by 1 minus alpha, but we don't consider this proportional factor anyhow. At the lower boundary and the upper boundary, we're interested here in the upper boundary. And so this is proportional to the upper boundary to 1 minus alpha. Now the upper boundary, since we are interested in the tails, goes to infinity. So for gamma going to infinity, this has to be finite. And so this has to go to 0. That means alpha has to be larger than 1. So this is only defined if the power alpha is not too small, so alpha larger than 1. Otherwise, it's not a normalizable distribution function. So in nature, by the way, we find often alpha element 2 and 3. So now the next question, of course, is interesting, is the expectation value, the mean. Is it, so we consider also the limes, upper boundary going to infinity, sum over k, k pk to the upper boundary, gamma. And that is approximately the same. We approximate that by 0, by integral to gamma dk, k divided by k to the power alpha. So this is k minus 1. And that is then approximately gamma to now 2 minus alpha. And we see this diverges, for example, if alpha equals 1.5, if alpha equals 1.5, this is 0.5, so it's going to infinity. So we see that the average degree k, so equals sum over k, k, pk, also the coordination number z, that gives this goes to infinity for alpha element 0 and 2, well, actually like that. And so we can have distribution functions which are well defined, they are normalizable, the probability is 1, but the average, the average of the expected event is infinite. And this is actually not so unlikely as you might see. If you look at the internet, actually at the World Wide Web to be more precise, namely of the degree distribution, so the number of hyperlinks on every website, actually the incoming degree, the number of links to a certain website, and then one finds in a log-log plot that is extremely nice. I can show you some picture if you like. And one finds over, not nowadays, but already 10 years ago, very constant over time, because the internet changes, that alpha is approximately 2. Sometimes one finds 1.9, 1.9, 2.1, and so on. So one finds that the internet is scale invariant, the in-degree distribution, definitively. And of course, how good you do the estimate, that is not so easy to do it exactly. Of course, the internet changes also, and you have to crawl the pages, and so on. But that it is nearly not normalizable. So that is the in-degree distribution. So the probability to find a web page which has n or k in links. So there are, let's say, 1,000 other web pages having a hyperlink to that web page, or 100 other pages having a hyperlink to that web page. So this is the in degree. There's also the out degree, how many hyperlinks go out from a certain web page. And the internet is scale invariant, and it's nearly not normalizable. So it's exactly on the verge of being not normalizable. And this is very interesting, and it's not really very well known why this power is like that. But it has been measured the first time maybe 10 years ago, or 10 or even a little bit more, 14 years ago. We measured that shortly ago, this year, and we still find the same power law. So even if the internet changes very rapidly over the last 10 years, I mean dramatically also the size, so this power law has been remarkably constant. And so this is not something very academic, but these scale-free distributions really occur. And with the internet, I should bring it extremely nice out. Essentially, this power law, this degree distribution, it's not only for the tail. It just starts at the beginning, goes over many, many orders of magnitude, and it's an extremely impressive distribution function. So this scale invariant distributions really occur. And of course, one of the issues is, and we will discuss that in one of the examples later in this chapter, is how can we explain that? Is it just a coincidence, or is it just we have to take as given? Or can we construct models, generative models, who of networks explaining scale-free behavior? And we will calculate a very simple and nice model of this later in this chapter, the preferential attention model for the internet, explaining, at least it reproduces the same behavior. Whether that's correct explanation is not really known. So this I would stop, and the next time we will consider graph spectra and Laplacian of graphs. So that is a question, how do you define Laplace operators and other differential operators on a graph? Yeah.